Cohen. At the end of Sapphire's 1996 novel Push, Clarice Precious Jones is on her own, raising her child, Abdul. She's endured violent and humiliating abuse by her mother, been raped and impregnated by her father, who also gave her AIDS. She prevails through a literacy class and the care of a teacher and a social worker. It was a powerful story that was made into a powerful movie, Precious. Sapphire's new novel, The Kid, begins with Precious's funeral. Her son, Abdul, is 9 and left to fend for himself in a lonely and sometimes violent world. Abdul is victimized and is also a victimizer who's trying to figure out who he is and where he belongs. Like Push, this story lets readers get inside the dreams, the fears, the memories, and the experiences of the narrator. Sapphire is a poet and a novelist, and she joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. Nice to have you nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
I'm really happy to be here.
Nice to have you here. This, I don't think I'm giving anything away. This novel begins with Precious's funeral.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And I have to say I was sad that she died.
Mm-hmm.
Were you
mm-hmm.
sad?
She is a character who I created.
Yes, and, I know.
I did not have that same sadness, because I think I knew from the beginning of her creation that she would die young, and I chose not to include that in the novel. Push, but at the time when Precious is diagnosed with HIV/AIDS, she is living at a time when very few Black women got antiviral medication. She would be many, many more times likely to die than an upper class or middle class white gay man who would be diagnosed with the disease and have adequate medical care. So because I have chosen to write social realism, I knew, given the scenario that she lived in and the economic conditions that she lived under, that she would not survive to past,
she's about 27, right?
Early adulthood.
And we're talking about the 1980s in New York, a particular time and place.
Exactly. And by the time she would have gotten access to adequate medical care, her viral load would have been off the charts. And it was a very problematic situation. And that wasn't what I wanted Push to be about. But that is basically what happens in those years between when we leave Precious in the book Push, holding Abdul on her lap and reading to him.
Well, and we learn in this second book, and it's in many ways Abdul remembering his mother, Precious.
Exactly.
She's a good mom. I mean,
exactly.
Not only does she read to him, she encourages him to ask questions, something that I can't imagine Precious. I mean, that would be a dangerous thing for Precious.
Exactly,
to have done.
Exactly. So we see through the child's eyes that Precious has been a good mom, that the cycle of abuse has been broken. So she, through the help of her peers, through the help of Miss Rain, through her own willingness to go to therapy and different things, Precious has broken the cycle of abuse and managed to give this child for 9 years a good childhood. You know, he's had his toys and games and the computers and all of that. But what we do see is the limitation and the tragedy of single motherhood. So she has these shoulders and she takes it all on herself, but there is no extended family. There's no boyfriend. There's no husband. So when Precious falls, the family falls. There is nothing or nobody for Abdul.
He is in a foster home for a while. He's
exactly.
actually kicked out. He's in an orphanage, I guess.
An orphanage, yeah.
For a while as well, mm-hmm. and gets kicked out after sort of strange circumstances. But he's essentially a child alone.
He's an orphan. We don't use that word very much anymore because of the connotations, the societal connotations that it has. It really speaks a lot to, a devastation that happens that really used to happen Charles Dickens describes it a lot in Victorian literature, that to be an orphan almost was equated with death, that these children really did not live. And because we like to think that those conditions aren't happening anymore, we don't use that word. But many, many children, once the parent dies, are relegated to a very, very hard life here in the United States now.
And was... it's hard sometimes to ask a novelist this question, but nonetheless, were you trying to both explore and, in a sense, humanize a child in this case, and a teenager mm-hmm. who perhaps on the outside looks angry, mm-hmm. does things he shouldn't be doing?
Exactly. Well, I was taking a child who had some horrific coping patterns, you know what I mean? He had been abused, and he dealt with that by re-abusing, by literally enacting upon others what had been enacted upon him. This was a child who, unlike Precious had no expectations. Every little thing that was given to her, she was happy for and grateful. This was a child whose mother told him, "The world is yours. You're going to be somebody." And when she dies, he is enraged. He is disorientated. He watches his dreams shatter around him, and he is, of course, very, very angry.
And I'm not sure he's a more complex character than Precious.
I think he is a more complex mm-hmm. character. You know, we could even, you know, our Precious was an analog girl. This is a digital boy. at the age of 9, he is actually reading better than Precious mm-hmm. did at 16. So he already has entree into an intellectual world and an understanding of the world around him that his mother was trying to grasp. So he is a complex character, yeah. And he is complex in other ways, in that the mother had a very limited access to power. The power that she had was almost purely personal, the power to transform her life, the power to learn how to read and write. But her ability to affect other people was basically limited. Abdul is a very attractive child, very mm-hmm. sought after, also very strong, and he has the ability to, I think it's Auden who says, you know, what every child learns, those who have been done evil do evil in return.
He says, and this book is really Abdul and his life.
It's stream of consciousness.
Exactly. I'm never sure exactly what mm-hmm. those words are, but he's in Unit 1 in Earth Science, and he says, you know, J.J., Brother John always calls on me, and J.J. is one of the names that he
one
uses.
One of his names, you're right.
I'm the best in the class. I don't know if I'm the smartest. There is a difference, but I am the best. And again, comparing that to Precious, who... One can't imagine her even thinking
who
that.
Who almost didn't feel she had a right to inhale and exhale, mm-hmm. who wasn't sure of her right to claim the oxygen that her body needed to sustain her. So he has a deep sense of competition. You don't have a sense of competition unless you really, really believe you can succeed. So this kid, he says it. He knows he's smart. Mm-hmm. He may not actually be the actual smartest in the class, but he's learned how to study. He's learned how to read. He's learned how to present and prepare himself. And he knows that he's hot. He's a hot shot. And he says it. I'm a surprise to them. They don't expect this of me. In other words, they don't expect intellectual excellence of a black male child. And he delivers. And he enjoys shocking them. He talks about going to the library to get a copy of the assigned reading, Hamlet, early to blow the teacher's mind when she finds out that he will have read it beforehand. So he's figured a lot of this out because he's competitive, he's assertive. And also the good part about all that is that Precious instilled in him a real desire to learn. And a real desire, based on her limitations, which turned out in this case to be good, that the way you advance in American culture is through education. Now, so he doesn't have a real sense of being an economic hustler or setting up a business or anything. What his mother told him over and over again was college, learn, do good, get good grades. So he has that yeah. in him.
And something that she was able to get or it get was, a piece it, of later it was, in her it life.
It was something that she was able to do and something that she derived tremendous satisfaction from. And also what we see during the funeral scene when her friends and teachers and stuff are talking about her, she got tremendous reinforcement in the society for that. So by studying, by going to school, Precious became a respected member of society. So she definitely passes that on to this kid.
Was it a challenge for you as a novelist to create a male character?
It was a challenge in a lot of ways. Sometimes, you know what I would do, Marty? I would literally say, to try to figure out what he would do, I would say, I would think of what I would do, and then I would have him do the opposite. What if that happened to me? I would literally sit down and cry. So what does that mean? He gets up and he walks. He gets up and he walks and he fumes and he takes the city by storm. And we can see him walking from one end of Harlem to the other. You know, in other words, he acts out through his body. You know what I mean? He doesn't ever acknowledge a certain kind of feminine defeat or despair, or if he does, it's through physical violence. I would do that.
Yeah.
And then I really had a, because always the novel, no matter how long it is always shorter on print than your notes and everything. I had a lot of backstory for Precious that I didn't include in Push, and I didn't even include in this novel, where they were talking, and because a lot of Push is about language development. Right. And so I had an idea of how he would develop language with this empathic mother, whose actual language herself was somewhat limited, but how she would give this gift to him, and how he would praise being articulate, you know what I mean? And so I had a good idea of him. We know that Precious, she talks about it herself at 12. She says, nobody believes I'm 12 because I'm almost 6 feet tall. So she can't have a little kid, you know what I mean? So we know that he's going to mature early. He's going to be big. He's going to be, I always saw Precious as big, but I never saw her as, people always say, why did you make a fat and ugly mm-hmm. character? They're not synonymous to me. I never saw her as ugly, so I saw her as having a rather very attractive face, and so Abdul has that, and he doesn't have the disability in a certain kind of way of being obese. So he has a fantastic body that he knows how to use, and so I envisioned all that for him. I also saw the alienation that his circumstances would give him, and you know, there's times when he passes a park and some guys ask him to play, and he knows how to play basketball, but he chooses not to be a member of a team.
Yeah.
So over and over, we see him doing the opposite of what Precious or even a woman would do. He doesn't seek community, he seeks superiority. He seeks to establish, like he says, I'm going to sow my seeds. I want to do this. I want to do that. I'm a king. He, you know, and I thought, I know plenty of people, guys who think like that. Some disguise it better than others. But I think he's a typical kid in some atypical situations.
Well, let's pick up on that after this very short break. And again, Sapphire is our guest today on Radio Times. Wrote the novel Push 15 years ago, hard to imagine, back in 1996. And she now has a new novel called The Kid. And the kid refers to Precious's son, her child, Abdul. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Also get a reading from Sapphire as well. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Mann Center supports WHYY and presents Three Singular Sensations, a night of music and comedy with the stars of Broadway, television, and film. Marvin Hamlisch leads the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra with music from A Chorus Line, The Way We Were, and The Sting. Actor Martin Short performs comedy and music from Three Amigos and Broadway's She Loves Me. And Broadway's Brian Stokes Mitchell sings hits from South Pacific and Man of La Mancha, Sunday, July 10th. Tickets at manncenter.org or 215-893-1999.
A blob of writhing creatures is marching across your lawn. What can you do? Who can you call? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss what to do when armyworms attack, plus organic answers to all your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
Same-sex marriage is on its way to New York. Don't Ask, Don't Tell is on its way out. Gays and lesbians are marking real advances, so why do so many remain in the closet at work?
programs and policies are wonderful, but they don't ultimately create the environment in which someone would feel comfortable coming out.
Corporate coming out, next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And if you're just joining us, Sapphire is our guest. She wrote a novel 15 years ago called Push that was made into the movie Precious. And she has a new novel, and it's about the child of Precious. His name is Abdul, and the book is called The Kid. What's so challenging and interesting, because this is a stream of consciousness book, and we're inside of Abdul's head. And sometimes I can't tell if what I'm reading is actually happening. Is it a fantasy? Is it a memory? Is it a wish? Is it a fear? Mm-hmm. Is it something that's really happening in front of him? And I'm wondering, even as a writer, how you enter that world. And it mm-hmm. is a world, I think, one can call of almost dissociation.
Yes. So what we do see in Abdul are a lot of dissociative mechanisms that he uses to confront and deal with the abuse that he has suffered. But one of the things that I really wanted to explore deeply, and we see it a little bit in Push when we look at Precious's mother, Mary, but I really wanted to look at the whole cycle of abuse, what it is and what abuse does to people and how Abdul himself becomes an abuser.
Yeah.
What we do know about people who abuse is that most of them are in stages of deep denial. So it would be unrealistic to have a novel where Abdul is acknowledging even to himself what he does. So what we have in, especially in section two, is Abdul will talk about what he did when he was dreaming.
Yes, exactly.
And we know, and because in the end of that dream, there are some police officers who are knocking on the door, we understand that it wasn't a dream. But the only way Abdul can tell about these horrific events is to say he was dreaming. So that's a lot of what you see in the text is I'm really trying to enter into this child's mm-hmm. mind and bring us the information of what he has done without having to go back into a third person and like beat people over the head with it.
Does it feel like dreaming as you're writing as it, well? And I have to say some of the passages in here are really intense,
mm-hmm.
really intense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There were a few things going on. Most of us have some of our more invasive and intense experiences while we're dreaming, because the conscious mind has the ability to shut mm-hmm. out thoughts. So we see in his dreams some really horrific things, and some of them are real. And I wanted to really portray what happens. What this is like. We hear about this every day, you know. I mean, we've opened the paper, the father so-and-so, Monsignor so-and-so at this Catholic orphanage or school did this and this. And then we hear the victims of this stand up and say, my life is ruined. I am not a full human being. I cannot live my mind. So, and we kind of are always on the outside of that. Well, you know, I've had experiences before. They didn't ruin me. What is actually happening to these children? Why are they so devastated? Why do they come out of these experiences alcoholic, abusive, suicidal? And here we see what happens. We see the baby psyche that doesn't have the ability to withstand these type of erotic experiences, doesn't have the intellectual background to understand what is happening to them. And so they take it in, and either they are destroyed, or as in the case of Abdul, they become destroyers.
Indeed, and part of that complexity is even as a reader is trying to figure out in a very concrete way,
mm-hmm.
did this happen? Did this not? Is he wishing to do this to somebody,
mm-hmm.
or was
mm-hmm.
it done to him?
Mm-hmm.
Did he actually do this thing? And there are a number of violent passages in this as well.
Exactly. Yeah. Most of the, if we look at section two, we have there. He's still in himself and in his life, and most of that is denial and dissociation. And he did those things. Abdul did those things.
Right.
Readers.
Yeah.
When we come to section four, we are really dealing with a breakdown. We're really dealing with a breakdown. We're dealing with an accumulation of guilt. We don't know whether what he tells Dr. C is the truth or not. But we know that this, I remember having one therapist saying, it doesn't make any difference right now what the truth is. What do you feel? What do you think?
Your own personal truth.
Exactly. And so what we see in section four, and because this whole novel is infused with various aspects of Catholicism, and I was thinking a lot about Crime and Punishment in Raskolnikov, to come clean in a certain kind of way, Abdul must confess. And he
to his therapist.
He must confess at least to his therapist. He in order to break the cycle of abuse, he must acknowledge that he has abused. Maybe it is easier for him to acknowledge that he hurt the person that he confesses to hurting in chapter four, because this is a vile person. We'd never hear him really acknowledge what he did to other little kids, but we have to remember he was a little kid himself. Yeah. And even I remember when I was practicing Catholic as a child, they would tell us that while children can do bad, we are not responsible for our sins until we become aware and of age. In chapter four, Abdul is aware and he is responsible. And to end the evil in his life, he must confess. And that's what we see there. Whether he's confessing to an actual event or not, what really matters is that he has said, I have done wrong. Mm.
And I have to confess, and this is not a criticism, but I have to confess that there are times in this book where I don't like him.
Yeah.
I don't like Abdul. Mm-hmm. I don't like what he's doing. I don't like the way he can justify it, way he can deny it, in a sense. I mean, we see it, and he denies it.
I think to me, that is, I'm eager to hear from readers and stuff like that. To me, that is the most accurate part of the book. So over and over, I have several texts. I spent a lot of time talking with therapists and social workers, and the way he justifies, the way he denies, is pretty much the way the clinical perpetrator's mind operates. And it's not really until he has Carl Jung talks about that a lot. I remember reading about Bill Wilson, the man who started Alcoholics Anonymous, going to Carl Jung and saying, can you help me? And Carl Jung said, no, I cannot help you. The only thing that can help you is an intense emotional and spiritual experience. And the only things that really pierce Abdul's denial and his justification are the experience he has with his grandmother, and then the experience he has with Milai, who he falls in love with, and then at the end with Dr. C. And it's no mistake that Dr. C's nickname is Dr. C, because he makes Abdul see what he has done. Even Milai can't make him see what he's done, but it is this doctor who makes him see what he has done.
Quoting again from a section that I'd like to have you read from a part of the book, but this is where Abdul says, but I'm glad to get mad. Mad, I can feel my feet on the concrete. Mad, I remember a little boy thought he was an Indian, got hurt by other boys. And in a sense, a certain gratification through his rage.
Right, exactly.
He feels alive in a way.
He feels alive, and what happens is that the rage actually keeps him from total dissociation. Remember at the end of The Bluest Eye, where Picola Breedlove, Toni Morrison's character, has been raped, and she basically loses her mind. The sadness, the grief, and the despair are so great, she goes crazy. What brings Abdul back, and that's the metaphor for being grounded and coming out of the dissociation, he says that I can feel my feet on the ground when I'm mad. I can feel the concrete. It takes him out of the dissociation. So in that way, what we're also seeing is while to the reader and to people outside, we're looking at some horrific adaptive mechanisms, they keep him from going crazy. Yeah. They are the reason why he doesn't end up with a needle in his arm and keeps dancing.
Well, let me just quickly reintroduce you, and I'd love to have you read a section where Abdul is dancing, and our guest is Sapphire, and her new book, her novel is called The Kid, and that refers to Precious, and I think we all know who Precious is, Precious Jones's son, and his name is Abdul, and he's had a tough life, and he discovers through the arts, through dancing, something about himself.
Okay. In this scene, Abdul is talking about the joy he feels when he is dancing. And we have to remember, we've already talked a lot about what has happened to Abdul. The day Abdul's mother dies, his body, the source of comfort and connection, that connection is broken when Precious dies. That connection is totally shattered when he is abused. The body has been the site of location and pain. It is through dance that he actually is able to talk back with authority to the pain, that you don't rule me. I am connected. He says, I listen to the beat. Ba-da-da-da-da. 1, 2, 3, 4. I don't care what it's about. I just want to do it. I start to move across the floor. The drums seem like my own heart beating. A guy has a long string instrument. It's pure fire. The music rocks. My body turns into an ear hearing it. My body is not a stranger when I'm dancing. My body is not a traitor tricked by white homos in black robes. My body is not a little boy in a hospital bed. I'm not a man, a big, shiny, and black man that makes the brothers look at him. Here, my body is my own. Here I am, a crazy horse dude who never gave up. Here I am like that dude Brother John told us the Schomburg got started by. Here I am music. I never been to no police station for lies about little kids. Here I got a mother and she ain't no hoe died of AIDS. Here in the beat is my life. The flute shrieks and I come again and again and can't nobody stop me.
And that's a Sapphire reading a section from her new book called The Kid. And I have to say, I enjoyed watching you read that. I have the advantage in that you're sitting across from me and our listeners are listening, read with a great deal of not just passion, but also you're moving your arms. And I know that you were a dancer for a while, so you know about that experience
exactly,
of dance.
Exactly. And just the feeling of authority and autonomy. And the idea that your body may have been the site of pain and may still be pained, and that you go through a lot of pain even if you haven't had any pain in your life as a dancer, but you are going to be able to create beauty with your body. You are going to be able to give pleasure, a healthy, powerful pleasure, to the people who watch you dancing. And this is what Abdul finds. And this is the thing that keeps him from becoming a psychopath. This is the thing that keeps him from, there's a section in the book where he's so sad and dissociated, he thinks about suicide. And he says, but if I do that, I won't get to dance. Mm. So this desire to dance actually is what returns him to society and keeps him trying to become a member of society as opposed to being satisfied with being an alienated outsider. And it's one of the few things that endears us to him is that he just doesn't totally capitulate to violence and evil. He keeps trying to be friends. He keeps trying to fit in, you
with
know.
Some with some successes and some failures.
Yeah, you know, he has a little thing with his girlfriend. He says, what do you do to get girls to like you? He realizes everything can't be about power and taking. He's trying to figure out some of these social skills. He's trying to figure out how to be human. What parents teach you. And he doesn't have a parent. He has to figure it out on his own.
Do you still dance?
Yeah.
Do you? You studied with Alvin Ailey for a while, didn't you?
I studied at Alvin Ailey wasn't teaching when I was studying there, but I studied at the Alvin Ailey School. I also studied briefly at the Martha Graham School. Maybe I knew when I was studying that I was never going to be a dancer and I was going to end up writing about it. So I actually studied at the Martha Graham School, so I know what that is. I studied African dance. I think I've seen some of the greatest African American dancers dance. It's just a legend now because there weren't good videos in those days or like we had not. But I saw Judith Jamison perform Cry.
Oh, my goodness.
And yeah.
Can change your life, right?
Yeah. So I've just, so dance has, literally dance did change my life. And I now, because I'm, you know, was never really a professional dancer or anything, you know, I really was a devotee. This is something that you do just because you love doing it.
And any dancer would love an audience filled of people that are devotees, right?
Exactly.
Hanging on every movement.
Exactly.
But we see some parallels here between Push and the kid in Push, Precious is in a sense, I won't say saved, but there's an intervention. I mean, there's a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
There's reading. There's writing. There's mm-hmm. a social worker that cares for her. And in this novel, for the kid, for Abdul, her son, there's dance. There are people that
exactly.
that care about him.
Exactly. There's dance. And there's also the as limited as she is, there's the great-grandmother,
yeah.
who is a really complex and crippled character. But she differs from her daughter, who was Precious's mother. And if we remember in Mary, how she acted in Push, it was repulsive, but it also followed a pattern of total narcissism, where Mary, cook for me, Precious, give me this, give me that. We see old Tussie give. She tries to give over and over again to Abdul. A lot of what she has to give, he doesn't want. She tells him, you have this apartment. And he looks, this roach-ridden apartment, I don't want this. He wants a penthouse. But eventually, he does find something that he wants that she has. And that's the story of her life.
Well,
and she gives that to him.
He calls her slavery
he
days.
He calls her slavery days. He is embarrassed by her. He cannot believe that he came out of, figuratively or literally, that he came from slavery days.
Mm,
so
mm.
she's here to tell him who he is and where he comes from. And he rejects that. He identifies with Jean-Michel Basquiat in the Armani suit, with the intellectual black critic Greg Tate, with Charlie Parker. The idea that he came from picking cotton, that he came from rags and barefoot people walking through dirt, the idea that he came from people who had to bow their head and say, yes, sir, no, sir, he finds that repulsive. But it's in letting that story in that his the shield, mm-hmm. his neurosis for the first time is pierced.
And he's vulnerable.
He's vulnerable. And he for the first time in his life since his mom died, he actually has something that he treasures, and he gives it to Herbie. He says, here, you can have this. And he's been a taker. Our boy has been a taker up to this point. And it's that kind of little magical act that begins to open him up. And we know that he's beginning to be human again, you know.
We're almost up on a break here, but just to fill in the gaps, this is his great-grandmother who, walks from Mississippi to New York.
Exactly.
To get out of the South.
Exactly, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to take a very short break and get back to our conversation, talking with Sapphire. Her 1996 novel, Push, was about a young woman, Clarice Precious Jones, and it was a powerful story made into a powerful movie called Precious, which I know a lot of people saw. It kicked up a lot of discussion and some controversy. And Sapphire has a new novel, and it's called The Kid, and the kid is Precious's son, Abdul, and it's about his life living in New York. It begins when he's 9, and it ends when he's 19. He's in a lonely and sometimes violent world. He is victimized. He's also a victim. He's a challenging protagonist. We're going to take some calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Einstein Healthcare Network supports WHYY. For people who suffer from chronic pain and aren't able to participate in daily activities, the Einstein Pain Institute offers specialized care in pain management. Through clinical trials, experience, and commitment to quality, Einstein addresses complex issues both to manage and relieve pain. Einstein uses a team approach to create a customized plan to meet individual needs. Einstein Healthcare Network. For more information or for an appointment, 1-800-EINSTEIN.
At the heart of everything we do at WHYY is one thing, storytelling. We try to inform, engage, inspire, and connect through deep, colorful stories. And NewsWorks Tonight brings together the best reporting from our network of journalists in one smart, lively regional news magazine. Weeknights at 6 on WHYY-FM, or listen online at WHYY.org and NewsWorks.org. There's also the podcast, and you can follow NewsWorks Tonight on Twitter and Facebook. And that's the story.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll preview the launch of Atlantis and examine the legacy of NASA's space shuttle program on its final mission. Also, Coastal Rise, Christian music born of a surf and skate culture. Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. Sapphire's novel Push was published 15 years ago, and it told the moving story of a young woman named Clarice Precious Jones. She was abused by her mother and her father. She managed to not just survive but prevail with the help of a teacher and a social worker and writing. The novel was made into a movie that got a lot of attention and won Monique an Academy Award. Well, Sapphire's written a new novel about Precious's son, Abdul Jones, who's in a desperate and sometimes violent search for his place in the world, and it's called The Kid. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. This notion of names figures in this book so strongly. What Abdul calls himself, what other people call him, and there's a section at the end of the book with this psychologist or psychiatrist, Dr. C, who asks him, you know, what is your name? Let's exactly. start with some really basic information.
Okay. One of the things that guiding lights for me, of course, this novel starts in Harlem. And, you know, there's that whole history of Harlem that Abdul doesn't know about or really care about. But one of the great essays James Baldwin wrote was Nobody Knows My Name. And this became for me a unspoken but very present metaphor as I was writing, that no one really knew who this young African-American child was, including himself. They knew what he looked like. They knew some statistics about him, that he's the most likely to end up in jail, and one of the 1 in 10 will be here and there, and he's the most likely to die young. But nobody really knew his name or who and what he really was. And that's part of the reason why we have so much inter-dialogue with him, where he talks and he talks about his dreams. He talks about what he likes to eat. He talks about who he admires. We get to see in his head, and we can, whether we like him or not, we cannot so easily ever pigeonhole him again. You know what I mean? So that whole, and also that whole idea of, if no one knows your name or you don't, it's like when you know, one of the first things my mom taught me, you know, in first grade was how to recite back my name and address.
Oh.
Because if you can't do that, of course, you stand a chance on the trip to the zoo and getting separated from your class and getting lost and not being able to tell people who you are. So we have that where Abdul gets lost because he can't really tell people who he is. And part of the oppression, every place he has gone, they have renamed him or tried to erase his real name.
I know you've been asked this before, but you were born Ramona Lofton.
Mm-hmm.
You took the name Sapphire, which I think, you know, you could has a number of connotations.
Exactly.
I'm not sure which one you embrace, or maybe you embrace them all.
I did embrace them all. A lot of people don't remember, but originally Sapphire in the African American community had a very negative connotation. It was like a evil, bitchy woman. But I thought
from Amos and Andy.
Amos and Andy. It was a stereotypical woman who was always beating up her husband. Or mouthing at him and stuff like that. And to me, while it wasn't a pretty picture, it was the opposite picture of the one that I had been exposed to most of my life of female passivity.
Mm.
So I embraced that. I thought, like the young kids today who embrace the word bitch as a way of trying to turn the negative into the positive by holding it close. So I took that name on. I also thought of it as a, you know, a new age name. Yeah. It had that feminist and new agey connotation of, and I was very much a part of that culture, you know, the crystals and the tarot card readings and
over
all of
you.
That. So it had that connotation too. And at one point, although I now know it is, and I thought of it as a more American or African American name than Ramona, which is clearly a Spanish name. And at one point, although that's not the case now, one point many African Americans did not want to be black or appear black, and they would take names that were Latin to try to act like they were not black.
So does anyone call you Ramona?
Yeah, you know, at the doctor's office. The the police want to see your ID, you know, that type of thing. But my friends and my family and professionally, I'm called Sapphire. And I would have changed it legally, but when I went to change my name legally in New York, they told me that you had to have two names, that I would have to make up a last name. And I was really adamant at that time that I just wanted to be called Sapphire.
So did they say the same thing to Cher, I wonder?
I don't know if that's legally her name.
Oh, there you go.
I don't know if legally, you know, like, I don't even think Madonna's name legally is Madonna. So, and there are cases of people who have done that, but they had to pay a lot of money and petition, and I didn't have that type of money.
Your two novels are about a number of connected things, certainly about abuse, mm-hmm. about abandonment, mm-hmm. About survival.
Exactly.
Clearly. But there's a lot of abuse talk, but I get the feeling that you feel like we don't really get into the nitty-gritty of what abuse really does to a person.
Exactly. I feel like we have turned it into kind of prime time, you know, bring the survivor on for an interview, and you know, like I'm just saw the and I admire the young woman very much, but the woman who Casey Duggard, who'd been in captivity for 20 years or something like that, and so now she's on the cover of People magazine. There's not a lot that can be done to compensate this woman, and she has a tremendous vitality, it seems like, and spirit. But basically, what happened is her life got robbed. She spent 20 years in a backyard. And yes, she can write a book about it and people can talk about it, but we're really talking about people whose capacity and ability to live life is going to be diminished. Precious Jones had every right to live and bloom and die of an old age. Her life is cut short by what this man did to her. All the healing in the world.
Her father,
all the healing in the world was not going to be able to arrest the progress of that virus that she never would have had it not been for her dad. So I really wanted to look at the tremendous repercussions of abuse. And I also don't think we're looking at it. It's interesting. It's tragic to me to look at what is happening in the Catholic Church. But what we're seeing every time we open the paper again, so we're seeing that this was endemic. Mm. This was happening a lot, and there is tremendous incentive to expose it in the church because the victims can receive economic compensation. In the family, what happens when the abuse is exposed is that the victim is disenfranchised, often disinherited, and receives none of the benefits of being in the family, so they shut up. That's part of the reason why we haven't, especially among the upper and middle classes, we don't have the expose of what is really happening because these young women and young men don't want to lose out. I had one middle class white man tell me he went to his mother and told his mother that his father had abused him as a child. And she said, why do you have to bring it up now? Because he's paying for your college.
Mm. But this sounds like an issue that you personally can connect with.
Of course. You know, I mean, I don't think I would be so invested in it if I wasn't a survivor myself.
Yeah. And does writing, I mean, the way maybe it helped Precious, has writing been helpful for you to...
Writing is writing, and that's why we have so many dysfunctional writing. I think the writing helps other people more than it helps me. What can help people is going to therapy, doing the type of things that you need to do, and choosing to, you know, making positive choices. So instead of alcohol to ease the pain, or instead of acting out violently, you start to learn other ways of being, and you know that's what we need. You know what I mean? I mean, I don't know what happened to Ernest Hemingway and Virginia Woolf and all these people, but we clearly see that writing does not necessarily save people.
Do you think of yourself as a survivor?
I think I am. I think I am. In fact, I know I am. The difference between a survivor and a victim, in my opinion, is a victim dies or a victim enters into the cycle of abuse and is caught into it. So in a certain kind of way, in my eyes, if you're in that cycle, you're dead. We see part of what we see is Abdul die psychologically in this text, and we get to see him come back to life a couple times, and in the end really able to leave the hell that he has found himself in. But I don't like to talk a lot about my life because I'm no longer drawing from it. You know, I'm really, this book is basically researched in a lot of ways, so there's not none of my personal experiences in it. But I certainly think that's part of what women and men can do is just begin to, without details, begin to step up and let people know this can be survived, and it can be survived without whatever it is, verbal abuse, sexual abuse, physical abuse. It can be survived without alcohol and drugs. And I think what we're seeing in the epidemic of drug use among young people are these are a lot survivors. And I would say 100% of runaways are survivors.
That there's been something.
Something has happened.
Some kind of abuse
something
that has happened to them. Mm-hmm. I hope this isn't a too personal question, but it sounds like you had a good therapy or a good therapist, or you've had a series of good therapists.
I sought out help. I was aggressive. I was assertive. I kept looking at life, and I kept thinking, I want the best possible life I can have. How do you get that? You know what I mean? I asked people, I said, how did you deal with that? You know, because that wasn't a part of my culture. That isn't a part of a lot of African Americans' culture. So that became very important to me, doing whatever it was I had to, you know, because I knew education was a part of my culture. But I said, well, you can be educated and still have these issues. You know, we see it a lot, you know. Mm-hmm. So I was really interested in what I could do to help myself, and I as the kids say, I got busy,
which helps.
Yeah, yeah.
Precious was made, or I should say, Push was made into the movie Precious, and I know you were really careful. In fact, Lee Daniels, who grew up in Philadelphia, directed the film, and it took a while for you to decide, you know, who do I give this book over to?
Right, exactly.
Did you think in any way cinematically about the kid, or was that in any way in the back of your mind?
No, you know, I'm really fortunate in that most of The Kid was written before, so I started writing that in the late 90s, then I came out with a book of poetry, then I put it on the back burner. But that book had really been conceived, and the writing, like a lot of the parts, In chapter 2 and what would become chapter 4 had already been conceived and written. So I actually think after, and Precious, of course, as we mentioned in the beginning, had already been killed off. I think if I had written a book after the movie, I really would have written a true sequel.
Oh,
I would have entered in and written, you know, tried to please the audience and written about Precious. So This is a book that I was sticking to my guns with, and it's a dark text. I think that if I was gonna, a sequel always has a certain commercial sound to it, and I think that I would have entered in and tried to give them Precious too, just to make people feel good. So,
were you pleased with the film version of Push?
I was more than pleased. I was overjoyed. I think Lee Daniels is just a magician, a genius, and he really brought integrity to that text and also magic, that you could take this sordid, difficult material and make it almost appear magical. You know, her dissociations take on a humor. There are scenes that he included that weren't in the book that I thought were just magical. The scene with the baby in the bathwater in the pool. It's a baptismal scene. I think that he has a real cinematic mind.
And Monique, who plays Mary,
and Monique,
of course, got the Oscar for
Monique
her portrayal.
Was outstanding, as was Gabourey. Monique gave us a moment in film that we have not seen before.
It was frightening.
It was frightening. She did in the film what I've always been, what the task that I set myself for as a writer. This is what I wanted to do when I was writing, to go to the outer limits, you know what I mean? I didn't want to do what everyone else was doing or what was safe and comfortable. I wanted to go there. And
it's a hard place to be, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, but there was part of what made that scene possible was that there was humor before and after. There were empathic, warm parts that we could relate to. But I remember one editor telling me of that scene that Monique did, which is taken from the book, that it would be best for me to leave that out of the novel.
Oh, really? And it was just too much.
That's her exact word. It's too much. It's going to be too much for people. It's just going to be too much. And I was thinking, that's the book. You know what I mean? It's just like those scenes in sections 2 and 4 where he's dreaming and dissociating, as difficult as they are for the reader because they're not linear. You're confused, you know. You don't know what's happening, you know. But, you know, like, I didn't know what was happening until I read The Metamorphosis by Kafka 3 times. I kept trying, well, why can't Gregor turn back into a human? Why does he have to stay a bug and die? Why do we have to see the dark underside of this family? You know what I mean? So in those dreams and dissociations, what I hope is that at some point the reader stops asking, are they real? And begins to look at whether they're real or not, what this child is doing. This is the film in his mind. If this is the picture that is playing in his mind, you better watch out.
Well, on that note, Sapphire, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio
Times.
Thank
you for having me.
You're very welcome. And her new novel, her book is called The Kid. And The Kid is Precious's son, Abdul. And Sapphire wrote the novel Push, her first novel, back in 1996. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. John Knapp, the engineer for today's edition of the show, and it's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.